Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here on this podcast, and I am very happy to have my fellow co-host with me. So first, he is the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com and the co-host of the Goodbye to All That and TV Break podcast. Please welcome Alex Marcus. How are you doing, Alex?
Hey, Justin. How's it going?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. Really nice to see you again. And we are very happy to have our other co-host with us. He is, along with me, one of the co-hosts of the Pod on the Rooftops, a podcast devoted to the rock band Genesis podcast, Noah France. Hello, Noah.
Yes, hello.
I'm so glad to have the OGs back in the house, as the kids say. And we are also very happy to have a very special guest on this episode. He is the managing editor for thepopbreak.com. He's also one of the co-hosts of the Socially Distanced podcast, and we're very happy to have him, Al Manarino. Hello, Al.
Hi. I'm happy to be here, and I'm also very impressed that you got my name right. It's sometimes Sometimes people struggle with Al. No, I'm kidding. People struggle with my last name occasionally. But I have had people when you're like at a restaurant and you're like, or like getting like takeout food and they're like, oh, what's the name? And you say, Al. I've seen them write all. And I'm like, do you know how to spell all or Al for that matter? So no, it's great for someone to actually say Manarino correctly.
Oh, I'm very glad. That was a first try. So
you rocked it.
Awesome. Well, we have Al here today because we have a very special episode. We are going to be doing an episode about underrated classics in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And why are we doing this, you may ask? Well, we had planned to talk about Black Widow, which was scheduled to come out in May 2021. Before that, it was scheduled to come out in May 2020. We all know what happened that delayed all of that, and that we're still sort of living through today.
I'm drawing a blank.
Yes, Noah, you live in the world, so of course you wouldn't know. And it was delayed again, unfortunately, until July of this year, although it appears to actually be coming out there, both in theaters and on Disney+. So in lieu of that, we wanted to still devote an episode to the MCU, and I think this would be a great opportunity just to talk about some movies that maybe didn't get as much attention. You know, you've got your Avengers Endgames, your Thor Ragnaroks, and like those are movies that it seems like everybody really loves, and there are some that, you know, still got pretty good reviews that maybe aren't talked about as much. And that's what we wanted to devote this episode to. So we are very excited for that. And we're just going to jump into it. So the way this is going to work, each of us chose a movie MCU, four different movies for the four of us. And we're going to talk about why we think that movie is underrated, what we think is good about it. And the rest of the hosts will be able to jump in and share their own thoughts. So with that, we're going to start with the first recommendation. We'll be going in chronological order, and we'll start with Captain America: The First Avenger, which is the film chosen by Alex. So Alex, do you want to tell us why you chose this movie?
Yeah, so the reason why I picked it is because I think that when this film first came out, it was before Marvel was really Marvel, right? It was Marvel had proven that they could make one good movie, basically, which was Iron Man. Hulk had a lot of mixed reviews, and then Thor came out. Then Iron Man 2 came out and made a lot of money, but was kind of a disaster. And then Thor came out, and, you know, some people like that movie for the fish out of water romance of it. Some people like it for the Norse mythology, but I think everyone can agree it's not really Marvel's strongest film. And then we had Captain America, which on its face seems kind of like a, you know, like hokey sort of throwback. It's set during World War II. It's not really kind of like in the modern like world that we're used to seeing superhero stories, especially at that point in 2011. And I think it was really just overlooked. A lot of people just didn't give it a chance when it came out. And then, you know, Avengers happened, became this huge hit. Captain America is not really the best part of the Avengers movie either. I think he has some good moments, but he's not really the person that stands out the most in that. And then, you know, Captain America Winter Soldier comes out and is this huge critical and commercial success, and most people talk about it as the best film of the MCU overall. And I think that that kind of established this permanent kind of overshadowing of what Joe Johnson and Marcus and McFeely were doing in this first movie. And everyone that I talk to who goes back and watches it a second or third time, or watches it for the first time, having not watched it when it came out in theaters, are always really impressed by how great it is at establishing this character that fundamentally shouldn't work. It's like modern movies should not be able to make this sort of classic, wholesome, sort of like idealistic, like patriotic character work, because that's just not the world that we live in. And it's easy to see him in a very cynical lens. And especially with Chris Evans, who we kind of take for granted now as Captain America. But at the time, he was kind of always cast as these like hotshot jerks, basically. And so the idea of him being in that role was also kind of like, really? Like him? And it's just so excellent. It's one of my favorite Marvel movies that's out there. It's so great at creating this like modern myth making that you need to establish this character in the world, because by the time that we get to the Avengers, like, the world has known Captain America as this basically like legend of the past who is now kind of out of the ice and in the present day. And so you need to do so much work in this movie to make him as a character feel like he's not only working inside of the film, but also that he's been integrated into the tapestry of this world that will last for decades and generations. And I think that they just accomplish it remarkably well. And they do it on the back of just an incredibly strong ensemble cast. Like, obviously, Hayley Atwell as Peggy Carter is an iconic character at this point. She got her own TV show afterwards. Every time she pops up in the movies, even in a flashback, like, people cry in the audience. Like, it's such an effective character. Sebastian Stan, still part of the Marvel universe this many years later, is really, really strong as Bucky. And I think those scenes, if you go back and watch, knowing what happens to that character, those scenes of him being more of just like Steve's best friend and like older brother kind of vibe, is just, it really hits a different way now. And then, you know, Hugo Weaving as Red Skull is like, he has just been like birthed in a lab to be a comic book villain, so it's just so great to see him in the role.
Wait, are you referring to Red Skull or Hugo Weaving?
I'm referring to Hugo Weaving. And you just go straight down the list. Like, Stanley Tucci only gets a handful of scenes, and like, you still think about him to this day. Like, especially like Falcon and the Winter Soldier is out right now. There's a lot of conversations about the super soldier serum, what it does to people, like who deserves to be a super soldier. And like, Stanley Tucci's voice as Dr. Erskine still like rings through your head, because he left such a lasting impression. And then even like Tommy Lee Jones is just aces in this movie. I'm sure we'll get into that a little later. But it's just like, that's an example of a character who doesn't need to be nearly as good as he is. And Tommy Lee Jones shouldn't even be in this movie. He's so overqualified, but he just lands so well. And yeah, I just think it's an incredibly effective movie. I love it so much. And I'm excited to get to talk about it and to hype it up a little bit. But what do you guys think?
I completely agree. This is definitely... especially what you said about, you know, at, you know, now having the experience of seeing Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and then Captain America, Civil War, and how the whole arc of Bucky has been built into a lot of later developments in certain parts of the MCU narrative. I would definitely say this is one of, out of all the earlier Marvel films, this might be one of the ones that has the best rewatch value, where having experienced the later movies allows you to even more appreciate what this movie does as setup.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Just to jump in, I love this movie. I think this is one of the most rewatchable of the films, but I can understand why people have, I guess, issues with it, in the sense of like, it's two thirds amazing. And then you get kind of like this, not weak, but just like lackluster of a third act, right? In comparison to what we're expecting in a Marvel movie. I think it's definitely better and aged well on a rewatch. And it makes up for it in the fact of those, that the first two thirds of this movie is just so enjoyable. Whether it's the you know, the training montage, or when he becomes Captain America. I mean, him as Captain America going to the USO shows with the music and punching Hitler is probably one of the most, like, one of the funnest, well, that's not a word, but like one of the most enjoyable scenes that's ever graced any of the MCU movies. And like, I can always point to that as them knowing the history of these characters so well and honoring that. And, you know, and not just saying like, we're going to make a modern, but like, I feel like, and we always shit on DC movies just because we can, and they're not good, but, you know, I feel like they never like look to the source material and say, this is the reason people like these characters, right? Like, we should honor this. We should, you know, the reason we have Winter Soldier is because it's a creation from, you know, Ed Brubaker and Steve Epting. Like, that's, you know, that's something that happened very, very late. You know, this wasn't Winter Soldier wasn't a character from the 40s, technically. He was introduced in the early 2000s, and they completely adapted that storyline because fans loved it, right? So it's just, they have such a way with being like so keen on that. They know what we want to see, and they bring it to us in a way that we don't expect. And I just love that about that. And this movie is a testament to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed this. This was the second time I had seen it. I actually saw it for the first time, not when it was in theaters. I saw it after I had seen Winter Soldier, right before Civil War came out. And I was kind of like, okay, I didn't really know what to expect. My expectations for it were not very high, because I remember it at the time being like, it just kind of being like this, oh, we need to have this movie in order for the upcoming Avengers movie to work so that we understand who this character is. So at the time, I didn't really pay attention to it. I was just like, oh, that's yet another one of these movies. And I'm so glad I caught up with it before I saw Civil War, because I really did. I feel like I had a better understanding of who Captain America was and what he stood for. And one of the lines that sticks with me, which is so simple but so key to understanding who he is, I don't like bullies. I don't care where they're from, which is something he says before he ever gets the super serum, which just speaks to who he is as a person, the things that he believes in. And he's someone who, it's very clear from the beginning, has experienced a lot of trauma, not just physically through his, you know, pretty much every ailment in the book, but also just from, you know, from being this, being someone who lives in a time that does not look favorably upon people who can't, you know, sort of physically, as a man, sort of, you know, be physically strong, and especially at a time when the country needs, you know, strong young men. And he wants to be that, and he wants to do the right thing. And I think that's the most, that is maybe more important to him than it is being like a representative of America, which is something I just, you know, going into this, did not know that was how they were going to take the character. And I think that's been consistent through the other movies. I like that this film feels like a throwback in a lot of ways. I think you look at Joe Johnston's filmography before this, and I think you could see that he was the right person for this. He has maybe a spotty track record with some movies, but he also has some pretty good ones. That I'd say are, you know, kind of throwbacks themselves. I feel like he's the right choice for this. I just think he really gets the tone. And I like how this stands in contrast to the other two Captain America movies. I think just overall, it's very entertaining. I think you're absolutely right, Alex, pointing out the ensemble cast. I was surprised how many funny moments there were watching it this second time. If I have any criticism, I would say it might be the Red Skull character. I gotta say, a lot of those scenes, my eyes just kind of glazed over. It's like, okay, when can we get back to like Peggy and Steve and Bucky? Like, that was maybe the one part of it that maybe I didn't enjoy as much. But it's such a, you know, there's so many other good things going on in this film.
Well, I mean, weaker villains has been a recurring bugbear in the Marvel franchise, and it took a while before the series was able to give us a few really memorable ones. But
yeah, something, it's true.
It's lack of motive. It's lack of motive for me, and I think that's the reason why Hugo Weaving's Red Skull, and just the Red Skull character in general, just never stood out to me as a huge villain, because he's evil because he wants to be evil, right? Like, I think the MCU gets better with establishing, like, motive for villains later, right?
Yeah, like Loki, you know? And Killjoy are in part two of the greatest Marvel villains, because you completely get where they're coming from.
100%. Yeah.
And yeah. I don't disagree with what you're saying. I don't think that he's the strongest villain. I'm glad, for instance, that he didn't come back in multiple Captain America the movies. Like, it was, I don't know if you guys remember, but it was like very rumored at the time of the Avengers that there was going to be a secret villain in Avengers other than Loki, and that it was going to be the Red Skull, like, returning from space. And I'm very glad that didn't happen, because I don't really think that character would work outside of this context. I think he works okay in this context. It's such like a heightened sort of throwback to like the serials, kind of like Indiana Jones sort of quality to the whole tapestry.
The campy Nazi from a lot of American war movies of the 50s.
Exactly.
And 60s.
And I think Hugo does what is asked of him perfectly. Yeah. And you can't take that away from him, even if it doesn't maybe totally work. And I don't know. I think that his scenes with Toby Jones are pretty entertaining. Even if it's like, okay, so he's just like evil because he's evil. But like, also, like, I just think that Toby Jones is such an effective actor who can really make the most of those scenes. And I think that that really, and that's a mistake that I think a lot of other films that would be similar to this wouldn't actually do. Like, so you have this kind of boring like villain who's just evil, like kind of think like Justice League, like, you know, the what's his face Wolf Mother or whatever,
Steppenwolf.
Steppenwolf, yeah. Marvel is smart enough to put in a character like Artem Zola, played by Toby Jones, and just like he can make a meal out of every scene that he's in with just like a look. And it never undermines the villainy of the Red Skull, but it just makes those scenes a lot more entertaining, I think.
I'd say he's the stronger villain of the two.
Yeah, like, well, he's the one that gets to come back.
He's the one, and all, he has the lasting appeal, but also the ramifications of them letting him live sets up, you know, the phase two, really, in terms of, you know, the end of S.H.I.E.L.D. and
most historically accurate part of the movie.
Paperclip.
I have to say something that I've always appreciated about Captain America, about Chris Evans' performance and about how they've structured his character arc, not just within the Captain America franchise itself, which on the whole, I consider the Captain America trilogy to be maybe the most solid individual franchise out of the broader. And in the ensemble movies, Chris Evans as Captain America is always one of my favorite characters whenever he's on screen. And I think a lot of it has to do is they really nailed the sweet spot of his character, you know, representing not what America is, you know, not being this gaudy, you know, red, white, and blue, you know, spewing uber patriot, but rather a representation of what the idea of America could be as opposed to what it is, and that it's a very hard to thread that needle.
I think one of the ways that one of the ways they get around that baggage is in all of the movies, including this one, he's consistently shown like bucking authority when it's going against his moral code, right? So in this example, he does it by going in and rescuing Bucky and his team when everyone says that he shouldn't, right? In other movies, like in the Avengers, he's going against, like, he's investigating S.H.I.E.L.D. and is saying like you shouldn't be using these weapons, and, you know, and then obviously Winter Soldier, like, you know, the system goes against him. So, and I think that that's a consistent way to establish him as a representative of ideals and not a representative of a nation, which I think is very necessary to make him work in a modern context.
And I just want to say that they could pull that off. But they
didn't. Absolutely not. And they did a great job with it. And I do, before we move on to our next movie, I do want to admit that this might say more about me than the movie, but I definitely cried like at least 3 times in the first 30 minutes of this movie watching it this time around.
That's fair.
It's just so effective at being patient enough to make those character moments land as you're building up who Steve Rogers is as a character and what relationships matter to him and what values matter to him and the people around him and like what makes them important to him. And it's just so effective that it just really, really made me emotional watching it now that he's gone and we see kind of like the after effects of his presence throughout all of this like 30 movie franchise, you know.
I just want to say again before we move on, I don't think enough credit is given to Marcus and McFeely for writing this five movie, because in terms of, I'm not including the Dark World and we'll talk about that in a minute, but in terms of they got to tell Steve's story over five movies, right? So you got the trilogy, and then you got Infinity War and Endgame. So that's amazing. Like, that's unprecedented in terms of cinema, where you can just, like, do that. And they do it so well, and each movie brings a different, like, nuance to the character. In a sense that the Cap that we meet in First Avenger is completely different by the end of Endgame, and for good reason. Like, there's so much that happens to him, and it's, I think they perfectly weave that throughout. It's incredible. And, you know, we talk about the ensemble films. You know, Avengers and Age of Ultron, I wouldn't say that Steve is, like, my favorite part of those films. I think he's
not. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not even central to the plot of what's driving the villains.
No, I think Avengers, you know, is definitely RDJ's movie. You know, he's definitely, I guess, the best part of that movie, arguably. And then Age of Ultron, I mean, I don't know what the best part of that movie is. I feel like that could have been on this list too. But again, I'll watch that anytime it's on TV, but I don't know why I keep watching. I think it's just, I want to be in this world and I want to be with these characters, but I'm not really enjoying myself. I don't know.
Yeah. Avengers Age of Ultron has, like, a bizarre rewatchability to it. Yep. I think because it works on a scene by scene basis, but it doesn't work as a film. So you can get caught up in specific scenes and you're like, oh, this is great, I want to keep watching more of this. And then you do, and you're like, oh no, wait.
Iron Man 2 is the same way. Iron Man 2 is super rewatchable, and mostly because of the Monaco scene and anytime Sam Rockwell is on screen.
No. The Monaco scene is insane.
No.
Yeah, nope. I love Justin Hammer.
Nope. All right, we need to move on before you guys continue to be more wrong.
Justin Hammer for president. Move on.
You've stepped on a landmine, Al, because this this is a bitter fight.
You're describing the worst part of the worst Marvel movie.
I agree with you, Al. Sam Rockwell is amazing in that movie. He's so excellent. Good. He's the best part of it.
No.
I really hope he comes back for Iron Wars.
Three Billboards was a much, much better performance.
Oh, boy. Well,
let's move on from there.
We're not going to be talking about Iron Man 2, but we are going to be talking about Iron Man 3, because that is the film that Al has chosen as part of this. And so, Al, why did you choose Iron Man 3?
I think Iron Man 3 was an inflection point for the MCU. This is the first movie post-Avengers. This is the first time that they're dealing with the ramifications of a world-altering event. The things that happened in Avengers, the Battle of New York, changes everything. Aliens are coming down. There is a bigger fight in the world. It's not just New York anymore, right? So Iron Man 3 is dealing with that. Iron Man 3 is like a therapy session for the MCU, and it literally is represented by that. You know, it's written and directed by Shane Black, who is one of my favorite directors. If you've never seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang or one of the best movies ever, The Nice Guys,
please go
see it. Those are phenomenal movies. But it was such an interesting pick to have him take over for Jon Favreau, who basically established the look, feel, and tone of the MCU, along with Kevin Feige and everyone else involved with Iron Man. But this is the first time Favreau is handing over the keys to Shane Black. And he does something so totally different with this film that's why I think it gets a lot of slack and a lot of hate, is because I think post-Avengers, every casual fan wanted just more of that, more Avengers. Like, they just wanted every movie to step up, take it to the next level in terms of, you know, action and big ensembles and things like that. And then you get this almost like quiet reflection movie of Iron Man 3. Obviously, there's huge action set pieces. We get to see the whole ending with the all of the different Iron Man armor and everything like that. But the movie itself is just driven by one of the best Robert Downey Jr. performances. I think, you know, the moments with the kind of prototype Peter Parker. I forgot his name. I always forget his name. Come on, Alex.
Kid with Harley, garage. I think Harley. He is.
Harley, yeah, thank you.
Kid with garage.
Kid with garage, or potato gun kid. You can also refer to him as.
That's a good one.
Thank you. So, yeah, like those moments with, you know, basically the fill in Peter Parker because they didn't have the rights yet for that was great, because you kind of see like what would Tony look like as a mentor, and we get that, and we get that fully realized you know, in Civil War and beyond. But there's just, again, it was an inflection point for the MCU, because they basically had to decide, what do we want to be? Do we want to be giant action movies, or do we want to be like, do we want to tell stories? Do we want to continue telling stories with these characters? And this was the first one that they did that, where, you know, it's one singular Avenger dealing with a completely different world, a different, everything has changed for him. He literally has PTSD from the events that happen in Avengers. And that it's a PTSD war story. Like, that's such a weird thing to do post one of the most successful movies of all time. And again, they get a lot of slack for it, but this movie's so fucking fun. It's so rewatchable and it's emotional. And you get, you know, Downey out of the Iron Man suit really for the first time. Like, this movie does not have him in the Iron Man armor for a long, long stretches of the movie. We get to see the man behind the armor because he feels that way. He feels that he's a man in the can. He isn't a Norse god. He isn't Captain America. He's just a guy who could build stuff. He's a tinkerer or the mechanic. So I thought it was really interesting. I also love the storytelling dynamic that they were using, like the way that he's in classic Shane Black, legitimately kiss kiss bang bang fashion, he's narrating the movie, but he's not necessarily narrating it. He's talking to his therapist, who isn't a therapist. We find out at the end it's Bruce Banner. Like, just a nice little, again, a nice little nod to, you know, the still connected universe. While this movie is very singular, very of Tony Stark, it still kind of fits in this, you know, bigger, larger MCU and the budding bromance of him and Banner. And that's why I love this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, when I watched this movie the first time, I didn't hate it as much as some people did, but I certainly wasn't as big of a fan. It was definitely a disappointment for me. And I think it has slowly grown for me over time. I think it's one of the few Marvel movies, thanks to Shane Black's involvement, that really has a point of view and a perspective. It's trying to tackle some like actual serious subjects, like you said, PTSD, but also sort of like the like political corruption and addiction and just like the way that we treat veterans in our society, and also the way that like media manipulation works in terms of like fear mongering with terrorism and all of that. Like, Shane Black is really touching on like a lot of stuff that we just don't typically see in these movies to that extent, at least. I think he kind of bites off more than he can chew, though, in terms of all of that sort of subtext, because it's sort of, he throws a lot of balls up in the air and not all of them really land by the end of the film. But I appreciate the try. And I also just like that he has like a real, like, he has a take on Tony Stark as a character. It's different from what we've seen in previous movies, like you said, but it still feels really authentic to the character in a fun way. And it doesn't bother me. Like, a lot of people are like, why did you make an Iron Man movie and you never have him in the suit? Like, that's like, what's the point? But I think that's exactly the point, right? Like, and I love to get to see him as a character be tested in this way and to show such ingenuity and to really own the fact that it's him who makes him Iron Man, right? It's his qualities that make him a hero, not just the technology. And I think that's important as a pivot point for his character long term. When I first watched it, though, I remember really disliking the third act completely. I thought, like, okay, you have this whole movie about how he doesn't need the suits, and then the last, like, 25 minutes is just a giant, like, clusterfuck of suits, like, beating everybody up. I know that in the production history of the movie that was kind of, like, a mandate by corporate. Like, they said, they told Shane Black, basically, you could do whatever you want, but you gotta have this big third act scene at a shipyard, because we gotta sell toys. And we gotta sell the trailer. We gotta have these shots for the trailer and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of feels like that to an extent. But the more that I watch it, the more those scenes, at least, like, the humor and the playfulness and the creativity of those sequences really work a lot better. And I also always forget, like, I always think, like, oh, it's, like, the last, like, 30 minutes of the movie. But even in that last 30 minutes, you have that, like, great set piece on the airplane where he has to rescue all the people falling. Yeah, like that's such a fun, creative action scene that's like so tense and just not like a bunch of people punching each other. So yeah, I think it works well. It also really develops the relationship between Don Cheadle and Robert Downey Jr. in a way that I think the second one is really lacking. And it's just like such an excellent use of Don Cheadle. Like you could just tell that Shane Black knew exactly how to exploit Don Cheadle's talents, and he's just so fun and charming and stuff. Or like the one part where he like pops out of the suit because they're like burning the suit to get him out. And he finally like comes out and he's like ready to punch people. And then like Guy Pearce just breathes fire and he's like, okay, what? It was just such an like he played that. Yeah. So well. And yeah, so I think there's a lot of redeeming qualities to this, and I think that the more people give it a chance outside of the context of like, oh, it's the follow-up to the Avengers, you know, I think that there's a lot to like about it. This is some people's favorite Marvel movie, and I wouldn't go that far, but I definitely think that there's a lot more to it than I initially thought. I just think that the biggest problem is the Guy Pearce character. He's terrible and he's like not a good villain and he's just so boring. And like you talk about like he's evil for being evil's sake. Like I guess it's because like Tony Stark was mean to him once, but that's still pretty flimsy. Wow.
I think the implication is that the whole world ignored him because he was an awkward nerd with a cane.
Yeah, I guess, but like whatever. He's not well developed. And he's also not interesting once he's not an awkward nerd anymore, so that's a problem. And Guy Pearce is an actor that I like, but it just doesn't work. And the way he explains, lots of physical therapy, my friend.
Okay.
Yeah, like the Rebecca Hall character was originally intended to be the big bad, and then Ike Perlmutter, because he's terrible, and he originally was the one in charge of Marvel Studios, said, no, you can't have a girl be the villain. Like, that's terrible. Like, how could you do that? We'll never sell toys. So then the Rebecca Hall character
goes back to toys.
It does. And so the Rebecca Hall character gets totally just like her legs cut out from under her. Like when she's introduced in those first two scenes, she actually seems like an interesting character. And then there's a turn and you know that turn is forced and it feels forced. And then it's just like, oh, we have nothing left to do with her. And I just basically want to say that we need to get Rebecca Hall out of big blockbuster movies, because this is now two movies that I've seen in the last few weeks of her being this like esteemed like expert in the field who's super competent, and then the movie doesn't care about it all. And the other one, of course, is Kong, Godzilla versus Kong, where she's like shockingly similar in terms of just like, oh yeah, she's like really important, actually we don't care about her, who cares. We gotta liberate her from this trend. But yeah, that's all of my thoughts on the movie. Justin, I'm really curious what you think, because this was the movie that you infamously never watched from Marvel. You like wouldn't watch it at the time, you had not gone back to see it, and I've been waiting like a decade now to see what you actually think of this movie.
This one and one of the other ones that we'll talk about, and then Iron Man 2 were the ones I had not seen previous to this.
Oh, you hadn't seen 2? Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, and this was – it's funny because I specifically remember at this time I was like really – like I remember thinking back in 2013 just like, I'm done with superhero movies. I don't care. I don't want to watch another one. So I just avoided it. Most of what I heard about it was from friends who had seen it. I got to say I really liked this a lot. I liked the – very different direction. I knew it had something to do with PTSD, didn't know that it was going to be like very much about that. I think there are some really strong scenes that involve the suit. Like there's one scene early on in the movie where all of a sudden one of the suits that Tony has just like begins to attack Pepper, like, and it's like honestly one of the scariest moments in a Marvel movie for me. Like I was just like, wait, what's happening? Like that's, you know, this suit which you associate with Tony Stark doing like very heroic things is all of a sudden doing something incredibly, you know, harmful, and it's just, it's very jarring. And I feel like having someone like Shane Black to recognize those kinds of moments, to recognize the iconography that we're familiar with. And I think he does this throughout the whole movie, like taking this thing that we think is pretty rock solid, like the Tony Stark character always seems to have a line for every situation, always seems to be like on top of things, confident, you know, this playboy energy, like all that. And to see him in this film just like as a broken man is so, I just found like very moving, just in terms of what it's going for with this angle of how he feels with everything new that's happening, like with even just like the way he describes being in that moment in the Avengers, like that one moment in space where he's like, I think he describes it like a tin can. There's just a real sense of vulnerability to the character that I think both Shane Black and Robert Downey Jr. bring across. And I that really worked for me. I do think there are certain, like, I get this idea of both the Guy Pearce and the Rebecca Hall characters as being like something from Tony's past that honestly he maybe hasn't given a ton of thought to just coming back to haunt him. Like, okay, that's interesting. I don't know if that super ties into the PTSD he's experiencing, but like it's an interesting angle. And it does tie into the idea of like the past coming back and affecting us. But yeah, I think there's so many scenes in this movie where he is outside of the suit, which I really liked, or just like there are scenes where he's jumping off something into a suit. And that's just, not only is that really cool, but it also like creates like a lot more tension than if he's in the suit to begin with. So I think like Shane Black is doing a lot of interesting things here. There are certain moments that maybe didn't work as well for me. Like, I don't know if it all ties together. I do agree with you, Alex. I think it brings up a lot of different ideas, and I applaud the movie for doing that. I would rather them like address it like at least a little bit than not at all. I think that's admirable. But I will. So yeah, overall, like I did really like this. I feel like more than any of the other three movies that we're discussing, it's the one that I feel like has grown on me the most having seen it this past week, which I think is a compliment to it. I am curious, and I know, Noah, we have to hear your thoughts on this, but I will say one thing that I think might have affected the movie for me is I did know the twist about the Mandarin going into this.
Sure.
And so a lot of those scenes, like, I just was like, well, okay. Like, I just... Like, I get the sense that he's supposed to be a smokescreen, and I like this idea of, like, you know, actually the rich white man is the bad guy. And like, okay, yeah, I'm all on board for that. but just like I feel like they're going for a certain mystique and a certain level of threat that I just never quite felt in those early scenes with Ben Kingsley. I mean, once we reveal that he's the actor, I think those scenes are really funny and really charming, but but yeah, that's maybe one thing. I do wonder if I would have had a different experience if I had not known that going into it.
I fully support everything that they did with the Mandarin. And I think that the way that you're feeling in that first half of the movie about the character is what Shane Black is looking for. I think the point is that the character is so sort of like missing the mark of what, like, it's taking these like very real like fears and like and ways that we could be manipulated and just going like a little bit too far in the terms of like theatricality and just like exploitation, and in a way where it's like, oh, there's something just like slightly off about this. This doesn't actually feel menacing. This feels like something else. And it's like a little bit of a tip to let you know that it's not actually a terrorist mastermind. It's some focus group's idea of what a terrorist mastermind should look and sound like. And I think that's such an excellent idea, and I think it's really well executed. So I honestly think that like your experience, I think you experience that movie better knowing the twist than not knowing the twist, because you could look at that signaling and misread it, understandably, as like, oh, they're just missing the mark. But it's like they're supposed to be missing the mark.
I recall the movie taking a lot of heat or it being a bit controversial how they did this at the time that it came out. But I loved it at the time. That was my favorite part of the movie. And it was the same revisiting the movie now. I thought every scene with Ben Kingsley was so, so fucking funny. And he just nails it so perfectly. And it's nice to see him get a chance to just ham something up, you know, given that he's known for, you know, he's more well known for his more serious roles. But yeah.
I think, Alex, you made a great point of like, you know, it was all purposeful the way that they present the Mandarin, you know, in the beginning before the reveal. And I think a great like signifier of that is having him communicate to the world in English, like, because I think everything else about him is very stereotypical, like terrorist of the time, right? Before, you know, like the homegrown terrorists that we're kind of facing now, it was like the post 9/11 idea of like what a terrorist is supposed to look like. And the fact that he's addressing the world in English, I think, is almost like a tell of, like, it's almost just like a little subtle thing, because they could have had him in subtitles or whatever, but I think it was just like a little more of a push of, like, he's not everything you think he is, right? I just think that's just like genius work from Shane Black. Again, I can't say enough good things about this movie. I love the twist as well. I thought everything they did with that was great, because it is one of the kind of only twists that we've had in the MCU where you were just like completely just like, wait, what? Like, are you kidding me? Like, the villain that we've been hyping this entire time for months and months of trailers, you're telling me that it's just the joke? Like, you literally did it as a joke? And they tried to do that again in WandaVision, without spoilers, but it does not land a second time. Even with that much time in between, like, they couldn't do it. It was perfect, I think, this time around. And for people who are like, oh, well, that's not the real Mandarin, it's not the real Mandarin. Grow up. We're getting a real Mandarin. Shut up. Like, what are you talking about? It's a comic book.
Guy Pearce is the Mandarin.
Well, now he's not. It's going to be the guy, the villain in Shang-Chi.
Yeah. Tony Leung.
Well, exactly.
So, Noah, what did you think about, like, the movie as a whole, though?
Well, like I said, I actually love the stuff regarding the Mandarin and how that was set up and executed. And aside from that, this is a movie of extremes for me, because the stuff I like, I really, really like. Like, the stuff with the Mandarin, a lot of the finale is kind of forgettable, but a lot of the earlier stuff, like him using kind of like scrap part Iron Man pieces without a full suit, is actually really fun and inventive. And they managed to work a lot of humor in that with the timing of certain things. And again, like, one of the few times earlier in the movie when he is using one of his normal suits, instead of it being mostly for action, it's to execute a really, I think, probably one of the more unique, like, saving people scenarios we've got in one of these movies. So that stuff I really like. Robert Downey Jr. is amazing. Marvel casting has almost universally been just spot on perfect from start to, it's actually kind of amazing. But Robert Downey Jr. has been, you know, alongside Chris Evans, I think, just one of the best choices they made in terms of how he, like, really got to sink his teeth into the character. And this is definitely one of his best, like, single movie performances. I like the way that they write the PTSD aspects. I like the way they depict it, the way he portrays it in his performance. I love all of his scenes with the young kids. So all that stuff I really, really like. The stuff that I don't like really, really bugs me. Like, I agree Don Cheadle himself is good, but the way they treated Iron Patriot or War Machine or whatever, at the time it bugged me, and it still bugs me now, because I'm like, it's like they're deliberately trying to be like, okay, we like, here's the black character saying, hey, I'm here, we can team up for the finale. Nope, we're going to thumb our nose at him. I don't think that was intentional, but it just, it frustrated me. It frustrated me at the time, and I never really felt like Don Cheadle really got his due for quite a while in the Marvel movie. So
I think all the scenes that they have at the compound are really good, and just, like, them teaming up in a really fun, effective way. And I think that they have, like, major buddy cop vibes in the second half
they
of the
do.
Movie. That
I
work.
Wish... I wish the movie had leaned more into that and been more about that.
They let Don Cheadle save the president. He gets to have the big save. Mm-hmm. So I feel like they service him. Okay.
Noah wanted it to be more like The Guard. I think that was.
I just, and also, and again, the stuff with Rebecca Hall and Guy Pearce, it's just not memorable for me. I just don't care for it. And, like, those are the parts of movies where my eyes just sort of glaze over. And I really did not like how they handled Pepper Potts in this movie. It was such a transparent setup just to get her into a kidnap scenario. And you can see it coming from a mile away. And it's handled so bizarrely and poorly. And it was very damsel in distress. Ish, and so I didn't
like
how it was handled.
Knock that guy's head off. So,
well, okay, so here's the thing: you see it coming from a mile. Like, obviously, they're not going to kill it off. Obviously, she's going to master, you know, this serum and develop superpowers. And then I love the fact that she comes in and she's the one who actually beats like really kicks the shit out of Guy Pearce and saves the day, but then has like this girly girl, oh my god, that was really dangerous, Tony Stark, make me normal again. I hated that at the time, and I hate it now. Like,
I don't know.
Pepper Potts has magma powers. They should have left her as that. They should have kept that. And it still pisses me off that they like ducked out of that. Oh, I fixed Pepper Potts, guys. Don't worry. She's okay now.
I think that Gwyneth Paltrow plays that scene really fun, the way that she's like literally feral and then she just realizes like what's happened and she's a little bit like shocked, but like Tony's really, I thought that was fun. I think that her, like Gwyneth and RDJ have such great chemistry. They could really make any terribly kind of like written role, a scene land for me, because they just can really bring it with their, the thing that I don't like about the end of this movie is that like crazy end montage where he's just like, yeah, so I fixed Pepper and then I decided I'm gonna just take this out of my heart, and it's like, wait, you could have done that? Like, what are you wait, hold on, like that was like two movies worth of plot, you just like undo it in a montage, like what?
Yeah, the whole reason for becoming Iron Man was that it was literally impossible to take it out of him. It was like, has technology improved that much in
Know that there was a special, and Marvel did this a couple of times and then stopped doing it because it was so poorly received both here and there, but this was one of the examples of Marvel doing a special Chinese cut of the film where they hire a Chinese actor who's like well respected and they give him like his own little tiny subplot that is only available for the Chinese market. And that was the case for this heart, and that was the case for this heart surgeon who's played by a very notable Chinese actor. And he's introduced, if you notice, he's introduced in the opening scene in Switzerland for a split second, and then he's the guy at the end who does the surgery. And apparently there's like a couple of small scenes that are only available in the Chinese cut of the film of him like developing this surgery and like being more of a person.
It's interesting. I didn't know that.
And so also, that's kind of why
that's
like
a very
that
dumb idea.
So sort of rushed.
We also get Yinsen again in the beginning, which is nice to see.
Yeah,
that was a nice kind of like full circle moment.
Yeah, he is the reason we have any of this.
Yeah.
It's all Yinsen.
The last thing that I want to say on this movie before we move on is the fact that I remember so much like complaints about, because this was the first Marvel movie that Disney had a lot of creative control around, and like there's a kid in it, right? So there's like Ty Simpkins plays this like adorable like child sidekick for Iron Man, and there was this big kind of fear at the time, very cynical, of like, oh, Disney's putting a kid in the Iron Man movie because now it's going to be like family and wholesome and stuff. And I just love that RDJ just like treats him like shit the whole movie in a very funny way.
He's like, stop being a pussy.
He's like, oh, your dad left, dad's leave, stop being a pussy about it.
I was like, oh my god, I can't believe that. He's
so good with kids. It's so entertaining. I would watch a million movies with him and like a 10-year-old. It's just excellent. And it's just, it really surprised me at the time, and it's still effective.
They should like, in like 20 or 30 years, they should do like a live action remake of Up with RDJ as the old man.
Oh my god. That's
I mean,
let's move on to the next movie we're going to discuss. And this is one that Noah, you have chosen. One that I remember you being a particularly big fan. I know that there have been some debates between you and Alex, all of which have totally gone over my head because this was the first time I had seen it. But you have chosen for us Thor: The Dark World, the second film in the, well, I guess quadrilogy. There may be more. We'll see. So why did you choose? Why do you think that Thor: The Dark World is an underrated classic?
Well, so I had long time listeners, all five of you, will know that I've had kind of a long-running bit about insisting that this is the best Marvel movie, mostly just to troll Alex. But that, jokes aside, at the time, I was convinced that this was one of the better Marvel movies to that point. Now, it has obviously been far surpassed since then. I mean, the top three for me remains Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Thor Ragnarok, and Black Panther. But revisiting again, I still absolutely stick by my opinion. It is not perfect. There's, in general, I think Natalie Portman never really came across as comfortable in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's probably for the best that they let her bow out of that. And it also, it's set up for an absolutely amazing punchline about that in Thor Ragnarok.
To be and she is fair. Coming back in the next one.
Oh my god, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yes.
Very excited for that.
Me too.
We'll see. And with the benefit of hindsight, dour, serious, Aragorn, very Lord of the Rings Aragorn-esque Chris Hemsworth is obviously far, many, many levels below just goofy, uber, like, Shakespearean, jokey one-liner Thor that we get in the later movies. So that was a definite upgrade. Like, the way Thor is handled as a character obviously does not hold a candle to what they ultimately ended up doing with this character. But I still enjoyed this movie tremendously, especially upon rewatching. The number one reason, aside from, you know, I do think even in the earlier movies, I think Chris Hemsworth is another great casting choice as Thor. He nails the character. But beyond that, Tom Hiddleston is just so much fun as Loki. There is not a single scene with him as Loki in any of the Marvel movies that I think is boring in any way. He's just having he has an insane amount of fun with this role. And also, even though he's in the movie to a lesser extent, and he's barely in Thor Ragnarok, Anthony Hopkins is so good in Odin. I love the way his very first scene in this movie. He teaches us that I went into this movie assuming that birthright has two syllables, but I was wrong. It has three. Birthright. Just the way he enunciates certain words as, you know, Odin, the god of the Vikings, is just so much fun. Beyond that, though, I love Idris Elba as, I'm blanking on his character's name. Help
Heimdall?
Me out.
Heimdall.
Heimdall.
Tough movie That's for not... Heimdall.
What?
Tough movie for Heimdall. He really, his only job is to see what other people are doing and make sure they don't come there. And he fails miserably on every front.
I mean, he does take down a ship by himself.
He takes down one ship. He lets in a huge ship that has a million other ships.
That's fair. That is fair. Anyway, I think what I love having revisited the film now, what I love more than anything is the production. I love pretty much all of the production having to do with Asgard and like the teleportation thing they have, the rainbow bridge, the houses and the costumes, you know, the way they just kind of wildly mix a lot of sci-fi and fantasy elements. I found the battle, the fleet invasion where they have like a sky battle over Asgard just to be really visually interesting. The way they have the Dark Elves have like these almost like sword ships that double as both ships but also swords, so just cutting through things. There's just such a wealth of color and imagination that goes into that went into the designs of the non-Earth parts of the world that I just found really beautiful and interesting to look at. So that's another aspect of the movie that I think really holds up well. And for the most part, I think the special effects hold up really, really well upon revisitation. So those are the main reasons for me. Like I said, it is not a perfect movie. There's a lot of exposition-y aspects to the dialogue that are a bit weak. The stuff regarding Malekith and the Dark Elves, it's not the best use of Christopher Eccleston. I mean, it's not good use of him at all. It's not like it is. This is absolutely, you know, the bugbear of boring, uninteresting villain with a very archaic and not at all interesting motivation strikes again. You know, I think that critique applies to the majority of the Marvel movies. And it applies here, too. Like, all that stuff is just not interesting. But all the stuff between Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston, everything involving Anthony Hopkins, and just the look and feel of the world, to me, are really solid. So this is definitely, I would not say it's one of the upper tier best Marvel movies, but it's definitely not at the bottom of the barrel for me.
It's really depressing, this movie, because, I'm sorry, the issue with this movie for me, you know, and pre-Ragnarok is just no one knew how to write Thor, and no one knew how to utilize the genius of Chris Hemsworth. Like, they didn't. They just couldn't figure out. It's almost like they didn't talk to him beforehand. They just, like, handed him a script and, like, do this. Like, I guess maybe he was too new that they didn't really care about his opinion. But, like, it took Taika Waititi to, like, see him do, like, a brief role in a Ghostbusters movie that everyone hates to see, oh, my God, he's hilarious. Like, he is so good, and he's so self-aware. Like, he could, you know, we could take him to another level with this character. Another thing that...
Well, he's also very good in Cabin in the Woods.
But... Oh, my, I love Cabin in the Woods. That's such a good movie, too. No, and yeah, it's true. It's 100%. And again, that's a Whedon production. Like, how did he not realize that? He didn't write Thor. He wrote Thor terribly in both Avengers and Age of Ultron.
I think he has a fun take in Avengers. I think Avengers Age of Ultron, it's a mess. Like, he literally said in interviews, I didn't know what to do with him. But I think he's okay. Like, he makes him kind of like the butt of the joke.
Like, I don't understand.
He makes him kind of the butt of the jokes in the Avengers. He makes him kind of like the butt of the joke in the Avengers in a way that I think works well. And like, he also plays up the Shakespearean drama of like the brothers in the Avengers. I like Thor in the Avengers. I think it's like the best use of him outside of like the later. What, like, in the first two phases of the MCU,
yeah.
I think that Thor and the Avengers is the best use.
Think Thor, the first one, is the best used pre-Ragnarok. I think that's it's a way to establish him, and it's, like, a very fish-out-of-water story, and I think that, you know, this cough, you know, this drink, I like it, I'll have another. Like, that's enjoyable when he's, given what he has, he's still doing something with it, and I just think the Whedon movies, he didn't really have the chance to branch out. I mean, that the best scene in Age of Ultron is the lifting the hammer scene, and it's not really because of him. It's because of everyone involved.
Yeah, he's just the person who owns the hammer in that scene.
Yeah.
And I'll mean, just say he this. Has also the whole like Fountain of Prophecies thing in Ultron was easily one of the weakest parts of that movie.
Oh, it's like
we have to get Thor out of the way for a little bit, so we'll give him some bullshit.
I remember it being totally incoherent.
Yeah, it was, and it still is.
It is, yeah.
We have to get him out of here because I don't know what to do with him, and also we need to set up the Infinity Saga. Like, it was
you guys ever seen like the actuals? Because that like the version of that scene that's in the movie is a total like recut thing that is mostly just uses like ADR and like voiceover. The original scene is available like on Disney Plus if you want to look at it the bonus features for Avengers Age of Ultron. It's like the concept that they had was like he was going to go into the pool, and then the Norse queen was going to take over his body and like express this prophecy, and it tested so poorly with audiences that they were like, we just can't do this. And like Chris Hemsworth is like doing a whole voice, and poor Skarsgård is there, and he has to like try to rescue him and stuff. And it's just like it's really not well executed at all. But it's like what we got was even worse in certain ways, because what we got was just like, I don't know what to do. We have to put the movie out. Let's just like throw up a PowerPoint presentation with the stones and be done with it.
The last thing I'll say before someone else can jump in is I think the reason I'm really disappointed in this movie is it is the villain, and it's not because I don't like Christopher Eccleston. I'm a Whovian. I loved his first season of Doctor Who. I just think Malekith could be and has been in the comics a way more compelling and fun villain. I think it was just it was miscasting and just misuse of they could have just gone to Chitauri. Like, it was just so bland and so boring of a character. Whereas if you know, I highly recommend if any of the five listeners are comic book readers, Thor: God of Thunder by Jason Aaron. And I think there's a few artists on it, but I think Assad Ribic is like the main artist of it. It's 25 issues. You're basically seeing the life of three different Thors from three different time periods, at least, when he's like young Thor, when he's first starting out, current Thor as an Avenger or living on Earth, and then like future Thor, which he becomes the new king of Asgard. But there's this, I think half of the arc is dedicated to like his ongoing fight with Malekith. He's basically like an alien, well, it's a dark elf, but like a mythical creature joker, like very just like chaotic, diabolical, and just unpredictable. Like,
That would have been a much better fit for Eccleston. That would have been a much better angle. Yeah.
It would have, and honestly, any other actor, I think, too. Like, I just think the way he portrays him is so, so boring. One of the worst MCU
villains. I don't think he had anything to work with. I mean, it's not a well-written character.
I literally just explained that he does have things to work with. And again, they didn't adapt. I mean, it was right around this time. Like, that arc starts in 2012, so that it might have already been in production. They've already probably had a script.
Yeah, but that character has a long history of being that in the comics.
Exactly.
It's like the way that I've had it explained to me as a not comic reader is that, like, he and Loki are very similar characters. It's just that, like, Loki is an amoral character, and Malekith is an immoral character. Sure. And but they both have that sort of like chaotic trickster energy to them, and that there's just nothing there in this movie of that at all, which is a disappointment, definitely. And would have worked better with the, like, at least half of the tone that they're going for in this movie. I mean, this movie has about 6 different tones at any given point, so it's hard to really say.
Justin, what did you think?
Oh, well, so this was the other film that I had not seen, and I went into this. I knew that, at least at one time, that Noah had been, like, a big fan of this, and I was curious to see, like, if his perspective had changed, which it seems like it has maybe been tempered a little bit. Would you say that that's true, Noah?
Well, like I said, the me insisting this was the best Marvel movie was always a bit.
Okay. Well, the reason I say that is because, knowing Noah as a fan, I did try to go into and say, like, okay, there's got to be something salvageable here. Like, there's probably interesting parts of it. What do I think of this? It's not good. I hear what you're saying, Noah, because I don't disagree with you that there isn't some interesting designs here, production design, special effects wise. I think the problem is the way it's, like, I feel like all that stuff is theoretically interesting, but in the moment of watching it, it feels deathly dull. And I feel like part of it is the direction, which feels very perfunctory. And it's, you know, Alan Taylor has done some really great TV work. Hasn't had maybe as much success in the movies. I just feel like there's a lack of wonder to this world, even with a sort of darker aesthetic, which I think would have really helped this movie out, really, like, lean into that absurdity and that fantasy, which I think is something that Ragnarok does a much better job of. I think that's a big problem. I think there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of lore. It seems to be drawing upon not just Lord of the Rings, but I think also Game of Thrones, which was kind of at the height of its popularity at the time. And Alan Taylor has actually worked on that show, down to the fact that even, like, the dark elves in those masks kind of look like Sons of the Harpy, but with powdered wigs. I mean, that was an interesting design.
Thanks for reminding me of Sons of the Harpy.
Oh, Jesus.
I guess it seems like there's a lot of stuff going on here. I just think it, in actual practice, a lot of it is not very interesting. It doesn't give you, like, enough of a reason to care. Like, it just kind of feels like words and things that are thrown at the wall, and they're kind of there, but there's not, like, a real sense of life or substance to it. That said, I do agree with you. I like the stuff between Loki and Thor. Honestly, it might just be that I enjoy Tom Hiddleston so much. I mean, because there's, like, you do get the scenes where he is a little more distraught, but then you get the more fun scenes. Like, and I think a lot of that works, even if you're like, well, I'm not quite sure what this has to do with the rest of the movie. And overall, like, I wasn't quite sure what the through line they were going for here is. It seems to be like maybe it's about Thor kind of realizing that maybe this isn't the life for him, that he wants a life on Earth, which would be fine, but I don't know if the movie is that story, but it seems to think it is, both in the way it's set up and the way at the end. And it's very strange. I'm like, well, that's not supported by the rest of what we're seeing. Like, it's a very strange situation. I definitely feel like the Malekith character is just kind of totally uninteresting. His motivation is just to make the world dark. And I guess he succeeds, because this is a pretty damn murky movie. There's some, I don't know, like, some, like, a lot of the, some of the humor doesn't work as well. Like, I was surprised how much the scenes with Natalie Portman and Kat Dennings and Stellan Skarsgård were just kind of like, all right, whatever. Like, there's, you know, I much prefer Darcy in The Wanda version Darcy than the one that we get here.
It feels like with WandaVision, they finally figured out why they wanted her around in this universe.
Yeah. So just overall, I can't say I was disappointed, because I don't know if I had huge expectations. I think I saw some of the things that you saw for sure, and I maybe can somewhat understand why some people might like this better than others, but overall, I do think this is one of the weaker Marvel films that I've seen.
I get what you're saying. I can get that.
Yeah, I will try to keep this brief, but I will just say that every time I watch this movie, I like it less. I definitely think that I hate this movie at this point. I think it's truly awful. Uh-huh. I think that it is it uses its characters very badly. We total waste of Jamie Alexander and Sif. You think they're setting up a love triangle. The movie is like, actually, never mind, we don't care. I don't know why, either do it or don't do it. Anthony Hopkins is ridiculous in this movie. His character makes no sense if you've watched the first Thor movie, because he's literally the inverse of Odin in that movie. In that movie, he's like, Thor, you are too impulsive and you care too much about war. You need to think about people and have wisdom and to not act. And then in this movie, he's like, I hate everyone and I'm gonna be really mean about it and be super impulsive and I don't care how many people die. And you're just like, wait, what? So hate that. That sucks. The comedy is just so poorly matched with the fantasy, like, high theatrics of the film. Like, it just, like, the, like, having these sort of, like, quips and jokes and stuff with, like, Kat Dennings and her, like, intern and everything, like, mixed with, like, this high, like, insane sort of, like, whatever Christopher Eccleston is doing. Like, they're not just in two different movies, they're on two different planets, both, like, literally and inside the film. It just doesn't work at all, and I just really, really don't like it, you guys. I just don't like it. It's ugly, it looks bad, it's dumb. Like, the way that they resolve the conflict is, like, they literally drop a ship on Christopher Eccleston. Like, are you serious? It's bad. The best part of the movie watching it this time around was to try to figure out exactly when Rocket was running around Asgard in the background that we don't get to see. Like, that was my favorite part. But yeah, it just very bad, not good. Don't do it.
Well, okay, Alex, to be fair, you think Sam Rockwell in Iron Man 2 was a good performance. So
yeah, but like, so does everyone else. So.
One of the best performances.
No, so we need to agree that I'm right. Anyway.
It's just bad. And I will say, like, Christopher Eccleston, you say, like, he has no motivation in this movie, and that's correct. I do know a little bit about the making of this movie. I know that originally his character's motivation was that Odin was, or like, Odin's dad was responsible for killing his wife, and he had like several scenes talking about how much he wanted revenge for this. Those scenes were cut so that way they could increase the amount of Loki in the movie after Loki popped so big in the Avengers. That's why you just like get so many random shots of Tom Hiddleston in the first half of this movie, where it's just like things are going on in the castle.
And the Black just, like, Dark Elf was his wife. They were clearly in love.
No, they're not. But like things are going on in the castle, and then you just go back to the prison, and like Loki's just like looking around, like, oh, what's happening? And like, you know, 5 minutes later, you just like, things are happening. You go back to Loki, and you're like, oh, nothing's happened still. Like, it was just like, oh, people like Tom Hiddleston, put him in the movie as much as possible. It's so bad. Also, like, the scene where they're like escaping and they're in that alien ship, and it's so dark. If you watch, like, there's so much ADR in that scene. Like, they clearly just completely changed the script and just made it like lots of jokes, because like the dynamic that Thor and Loki have in this movie for most of the time is very much like this kind of angsty brother relationship. But in that scene, it's tons of like one-liners for some reason that are just like totally out of character for Thor. And it's like, oh, they just needed more jokes because it was too dull of a movie. And I know they also inserted more Kat Dennings into the film in reshoots for that same reason, to get more comedy in there. And it just, like, I wish they had just had the confidence to make the boring fantasy movie that they wanted to make, because at least it would have had a consistent tone and creative vision. This is just such a mashup of a bunch of nonsense that just doesn't go well together.
See, the mashup all felt very tongue-in-cheek to me, and I guess that's why I always enjoyed watching it, because it felt like, no, this movie is just being what it is.
I'm so glad that Patty Jenkins didn't direct this and just completely tank her career.
Well, this was not at all the script that Patty Jenkins was going to direct. Like, she had an entirely different story. And it was like, going to have a female villain, and it was going to be centered on a love story. And, it like, that was the whole – and when Marvel was like, we're not going to do that, then she walked away from the project.
That's what I'm saying.
I would have loved to see the movie that she wanted to make.
Me too, but I'm saying I'm so glad that she didn't get, you know, potentially –
Yeah, that she walked away. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so glad she walked away, because we would never have gotten Wonder Woman. And we would never have gotten the greatness that is Wonder Woman 1984, which is – Still, oh. I don't understand how that was made. I don't get it. People said yeah to a lot of those decisions. I don't know.
A lot of people said yes.
Maybe a little too much confidence there.
Way too much.
Also, I love the idea that in this movie, like, they recast Zachary Levi as Fandral, so that way he can have, like, four lines of dialogue. Like, why couldn't you just let the other guy come back?
Oh, that wasn't his fault. He was too busy with Once Upon a Time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought it was a schedule.
That was the reason he was recasted. So Zach Levi stepped in, and I think his thing was like, hey, at least I'm in something. Like, I don't think I'll ever get to do anything.
He's the most shafted of, like, any, like, supporting character, I think, because he got cast in this movie, has literally nothing to do, has, like, one line where he's like, if you hurt Thor, I'm gonna hurt you, or whatever, and that's it. And then in this, and then he comes back for the third movie where he literally has no lines of dialogue, gets killed within 3 seconds.
Like, I think he talked about that. I don't know if he was already still in the running or he had been casted as Shazam, and I think he was just like, yeah, you can just kill me off, whatever.
Like, I think he was happy to go. But, like, he literally had to fly to Australia to shoot that scene. And it's literally just, like, his job is to just stand in front of a green screen and then be immediately killed by Cate Blanchett. I mean, there's worse things than to be killed by Cate Blanchett in a movie, so I guess.
There's also worse things than free trips to Australia and getting paid for it.
I don't know. I don't think he got to stay in Australia very long. And
he did get paid, and that's all.
It's a rough flight.
Oh, who cares? But yeah, I think that's way too much time dedicated to that movie. Way too much time. What a footnote. Sorry. I don't like that movie.
Also, the ether makes no sense. Like,
it's nonsense.
Yeah.
I love how Thor describes it in Endgame. Like, he can't even describe it because he didn't even pay attention.
And another thing that I hate about this movie is that there's, like, so we have this whole opening, like, sequence, like, a prologue. I have to get this out. So, like, there's the opening sequence where it's, like Anthony Hopkins is, like, and then there were dark elves, right? And, like, he tells you all about this stuff. And then, like, 45 minutes into the movie, they literally do it again. Also, Anthony Hopkins giving basically the same speech, explaining to our characters what's up with the dark elves. Like, why would you do both things? Like, just pick one. Either do the intro or do it in the movie. Why do we need to have the same exposition dump twice by the same character? Stupid. I hate it.
That was Anthony Hopkins.
The one thing they can get rid of in the Thor movies is the information dumps. They even do it in Ragnarok too, of, like, explaining, like, Hela and the ongoing battles and stuff. It's just like, send it to me in an email. Like, I don't want to do this.
At least that looked cool, though, in Ragnarok.
Put it in a Fortnite cutscene.
Yeah, the visual was dope. That is.
Put it in a Fortnite cutscene, because that's what Disney does now.
Yeah, that's true.
My last thing that I'll say about this movie is, you know you're in a bad spot when you've got Odin talking about his father, Boar. So.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's a good one.
Moving on.
I can stand that.
But thank you, Noah, even though it seems like the three of us are not really on board for this one.
Remain right no matter what. So
of course.
No skin off my back.
Well, that goes without saying. But I'm going to bring up the movie that I've chosen for this. And this is Ant-Man and the Wasp, directed by Peyton Reed. It is from 2018, notably the film that came out, I believe it was the first Marvel film after Infinity War, I think.
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
It was.
Yeah.
It came out the same year.
Captain Marvel comes out.
Everyone was going to be asking, okay, is the film before or after the events of Infinity War? How are they going to deal with Thanos? And then the film comes out, and it turns out it's like going at the same time as that.
Right. Yes. I'm sorry. I was just trying to figure out when Captain Marvel came out. Was that post Ant-Man and the Wasp or pre?
Yes.
Yeah. It was 2019.
Yeah, the release schedule is Infinity War was early summer, Ant-Man and the Wasp was mid-summer, then you go to Captain Marvel, spring, Endgame, summer.
Justin, I apologize. Continue.
Oh, no problem. So why did I choose this one? Well, a couple of reasons. One is because I don't feel like I hear about it, even though a lot of people seem to have liked it at the time. Watching it this time, it just confirmed me just how fun this movie is. I mean, some of the things you were talking about, Noah, with Thor: The Dark World, I feel like are fully realized in this movie, just with the pacing, the action, the chemistry among the cast, and just the inventiveness of it. I mean, there's so much that they do just with the shrinking and the resizing of objects, which I still just found like not just exciting, but also just really hilarious. I mean, there's been a lot of car chases in San Francisco in the movies. Not many with giant Pez dispensers that I can think of. You've got all that stuff. I think also watching it this time, and this is not something that I think the filmmakers intended, although it still had resonance for me, is the whole conceit of Scott having this house arrest for 2 years. Boy, I could relate to that more than I ever wanted to. Especially because in the film, it's like he only has 3 days left, and I'm just like, just got my first shot and like counting down the days until the second, and then the 14 days after that. Starting to see some daylight, and I'm like, yeah, I can relate to that, where it's like it feels so close, and yet it's because it's not there, it still feels far away. Could really relate to that this time. But I think the other reason, and this is in addition to all the humor and the antics and the just the romp that this movie is, which are all things that you want in a summer blockbuster, especially after Infinity War, which I do like a lot, but also is kind of a downer, to say the least. I think it's got all that fun stuff, and yet there is this theme running through it of doing the self-sacrifice for the ones that we love. I think that's threaded through in so many of these characters, both in the histories of with like Janet Van Dyne and the choice that she made, but also this sense of reconciliation that like there's this feeling that you might have people in your life who will try to help you in your hour of need. So all that stuff, and I think a lot of that moved me the first time, and seeing it this time, I was surprised just how it moved me, especially toward the end. There are a lot of reunions and mended relationships in this movie. And on top of all of the fun stuff, like I mentioned, it just has a layer of poignancy that I think maybe doesn't get talked about as much. And I think I think there's a lot of just great acting from this entire cast. I'm a big fan of the character Ghost, played by Hannah John Kamen. The fact that her whole thing is like the whole reason she's in the predicament she is, where she can't control like her material form, came from a moment of self-sacrifice, came from a moment where just irrationally, instinctively, she needed to be with her father at his, basically, you know, at his death. And now she spends most, like, she's almost like having to overcompensate. Like, she just becomes she's driven to this opposite extreme of self-preservation. And this is all just, like, in what the characters do. It's all, like, it's all there, I think, under the surface. And I think it doesn't feel like it's ever totally out of whack with the rest of it. So just for all those reasons, I have a real soft spot for this movie. And which is maybe a little strange because I don't remember being a big fan of the original Ant-Man. But maybe I need to revisit it. It has been a little while. I've only seen it the one time. But what do you guys feel about Ant-Man and the Wasp?
I will say two words: Jimmy Woo. Like, that's all you need. I mean, the introduction of Jimmy Woo into the MCU proper is enough to make this movie a great movie. No, I love it. I really did enjoy this movie, and it's funny because I had not rewatched it after seeing it in theaters. I thought of this movie when I first watched it. I was like, wow, this was really fun. It was really enjoyable. But I think the one thing that stuck with me was just the lead-in to Endgame. That was really it. It was just like a huge question was answered for us, right? Because everyone was suspecting that something had to do, you know, with the quantum realm was going to be the key to saving, you know, all the heroes we lost and the other billions of life forms. So that's what I remember the most about this movie. But I also remember, like, you know, as you mentioned, the whole house arrest scene, montage, if you will, is phenomenal. Jimmy Woo, the comedy. I mean, when Scott gets shrunk down to like kid form, was in so like such like great like slapstick. But I will say, and you mentioned this, revisiting Ant-Man. Ant-Man is in the top 10, maybe even top 5 for me. It is a great movie. It is such a great movie, and it's mostly like 99% due to Paul Rudd. Like, Paul Rudd's performance in that makes it so much fun. And it's like Marvel taking a chance on something new with, like, oh, like, what if we made a caper movie? Like, what if we just made like a robbery movie with a hero? Like, it's a good guy. It's like Ocean's 11 meets the MCU. Like, I thought, like, such a great concept, so fun. And I shouldn't like that movie because I'm a huge Edgar Wright fan, and it's, I think, one of the biggest what ifs in cinema is what would Edgar Wright's Ant-Man look like, which we'll never get an answer to. But the Ant-Man and the Wasp, going back to the original point of the podcast, is just so solid. The only problem with it is the timing. You're sandwiched in between two of the most successful movies in the MCU's history, two of the most important, and you're almost like a footnote on it. You're a lead-in. You're just trying to help further the plot for the finale of, you know, the first decade plus of the MCU. That's the biggest issue with that movie, is just timing.
So I enjoyed both Ant-Man and this movie at the time that I saw it, and I had a lot of fun revisiting it. And I would absolutely agree. All the other stuff that in there that there is to like aside, the Ant-Man character, again, just the casting of Paul Rudd, so perfect. And something that really struck me this time around, and that I've decided makes it for me one of the most famous, one of the reasons why I especially like Paul Rudd's Ant-Man, is how, you know, so many, not just within Marvel, but in general, when you talk about superheroes or costumed heroes or people with superpowers, a lot of the story or the reasons as to why, how they got those powers, why they use those powers the way they do, like whatever it is, so much of it is built around trauma or tragedy of some kind. And in some way, a lot of those characters as people are kind of broken. You know, like Robert Downey Jr. is, you know, his Tony Stark is just riddled with problems. And that's part of what makes him such an interesting character, is how he tries to adapt to these problems. You know, Chris Evans is Captain America, like he's a fundamentally decent person, but he goes through this incredible trauma of just skipping 70 years of the world and then having to come to terms with that. But Paul Rudd's Ant-Man, he's a good guy. He's a divorced dad, which is kind of singular in the world of superhero comic book movies. We just don't get that often. Like, you know, and he's a nice guy. Who, you know, is, you know, has a checkered past, but he's, as a person, he's fundamentally decent, and he has a happy, healthy relationship with his kid and with his ex and with his ex's new husband. And it just struck me watching this movie, like, you know, his personal life is kind of, it's okay. Like, he's happy. He's a great dad. He's got a great kid. I love all of his scenes with his daughter. I think their dynamic is just so much fun. But even the fact that the movie takes the time to show, like, he's got his personal situation is kind of figured out. Like, he knows what drives him. He knows what makes him happy. And that's kind of refreshing in a way. That makes him a bit of an outlier. And I really appreciated revisiting that this time around. It's definitely something that I hadn't thought much about before. But that I'm definitely going to pay attention to again either. And it makes it even more heartbreaking watching this movie and realizing, oh, shit, he's about to miss 5 years of his daughter's life.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He becomes like a tragic character, which is insane when you think about it, because he's like the most happy-go-lucky character in the MCU. I mean, look at when he meets Captain America for the first time in Civil War. Like, yeah. That's the Scott Lang that we're so used to. And it's yeah. it's crazy that he becomes almost a, you know, tragic-esque character when, you know,
just we get to see... One of the most heartbreaking moments in Endgame is at the beginning when he sees his daughter and he just goes,
"Yeah,
you're yeah. so big.
So big."
That makes me cry every time.
As a father, kills me.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that. I can't imagine just...
Paul Rudd plays that scene so expertly. Yeah. Like, it's just... It's maybe, like, the best acting I've seen him do, and I've seen him be in a lot of things.
Yeah. I think I'm with you there.
But yeah, I love this movie, too. I'm so glad that, Justin, you gave me a chance to rewatch it. All I have to say about it is just, like, it's fun! Because it is. It's, like, it's a blast. I would agree that it's underrated. Because, like Al said, it kind of was, like, oh, like, it was treated as this, like, fun kind of, like, interlude between these two giant blockbusters, because that's exactly what it was. But I think that there's a lot of heart to it, as everyone has said. And, you know, people complain, well, the stakes aren't very high. There's not really one villain that anybody cares about. There's just, like, a bunch of, like, antagonists running around bouncing off each other. It's like, yeah, that's why it's interesting. Like, we've seen a million versions of a superhero movie with high stakes and one villain that's, like, trying to take over the world, like Thor: The Dark World, for instance. And I think it's fun that they were like, no, we're going to tell this story on, like, a broad tapestry with a lot of interesting characters that are, like, kind of, you know, like, nobody is evil. No one is, like, trying to, like, dominate, like, the planet. It's just kind of, like, a bunch of, like, antagonists with different motivations, and some of them are more, like, selfish, but in an altruistic, like, selfish, but, like, in an understandable way. Like, Walter Goggins is just, like, he's just a mobby kind of guy who works for somebody else. Like, It's just fun. It's fun. The character dynamics are really well honed. And
I just realized we never find out who he works for. He keeps saying, "I work for very violent people." We yeah. never find out.
We don't. It's a lingering plot thread. I think I have suspicions on who he works for. I think it's going to tie into the whole Kang the Conqueror character, who is supposed to be coming in Ant-Man 3, Quantumania. And yeah. he's going to be played by Jonathan Majors, who's an excellent actor. Yeah. And he's going to be kind of like a big bad for multiple movies. And that's my hunch is that's who the unnamed character in this one is.
That'd be great, because I love Walton Goggins. I want him back.
Yeah. And he's still on the board. You know, they didn't kill him, so he come back.
I want him to be Walton Goggins and Sam Rockwell. Make it. Happy.
Wow. Okay. That's a step too far. I love that. I have to say, if I have one critique of the movie on the whole, it's the Lawrence Fishburne character. It's never bad because it's Lawrence Fishburne and he's that amazing. It's his character doesn't really work that much for me because there are a lot of turns that happen, and none of them really, really click for me. Like, at first he's just an antagonistic former employee, and then he's the bad guy mastermind, and then, oh no, he's working with this assassin, but now all of a sudden he's getting cold feet. And it feels like, it felt very artificial, the way his character kind of...
I like the fact that he sticks around
to the end, and that he shows he kind of, like, he genuinely adopts Ghost. But it was one of the less compelling character arcs in the movie.
I don't really think that there's that much back and forth in terms of his plot progression and his character progression. I think it's more of, like... He's presented as someone who doesn't like Hank Pym, as we all should not like Hank Pym because he's a jerk. And he cares about this girl and he wants to protect her, and he's come up with a plan to try to protect her. And maybe it's a slightly risking Janet in a way that, like, obviously Janet's family doesn't want to take that risk, but he's not actively trying to hurt her. Right. He's just kind of more self-motivated or self-interested in his approach to the problem. And then, like, when Ghost starts to be like, well, what if I kill everybody? He's like, no, don't do that. I'm a good person. Don't do that. And then she's like, all right, fine. And then they, like, run off together and be, like, surrogate dad and daughter. And it's like, that's... So I feel like that tracked for me. And I think Lawrence Fishburne is great in it.
Yeah. It's a minor criticism. It's yeah.
Yeah, and I just wanted to respond to one thing you mentioned, Alex, about the stakes. I read mostly positive things about this. You know, talking about the placement, I think that the way that you did, Al, makes a lot more sense to me, maybe why this has gotten lost. I think one of the reasons why this, like, the stakes in this movie work for me, and the fact that they're not, you know, earth-shattering, or, you know, literally or figuratively, is like, that's what I liked about it. Like, that's, you know, like, the stakes are, they might not be as significant, but they feel very personal. You know, when Scott makes the decision to help Hope and Hank with their thing, like, that's something where he's, not only is he helping them because he cares about them, but he's also potentially sacrificing his own freedom to be with his family and, well, to be out in the world, I guess. So all these, like, so the stakes are maybe not on the level of what they are in Thor: The Dark World, for example, but they still feel significant because they're very personal. And I think that is threaded through in all the characters. Like, everybody want, like, this sense of being able to do the things you can, recognizing that you can't change the past and saying, okay, we're going to work the problem. How do we make this work now? And I think that's true in, like, almost any scene in this, like the scene where, like you mentioned, Alex, the scene between Fishburne and Hannah John Kamen, where he says, like, she's like, I'm not a good person. You should not be with me. And he's like, that doesn't matter to me. I care about you. That's what matters. And I just think it's just, there's something really hopeful about that. I think for anyone who's been through a tough spot, to know that you still have people that care about you, I think this, you know, and I recognize that's not going to be the case for everybody. I think in an ideal world, that would be great. But I think this film is full of that hope. It's about recognizing the relationships that you do have in this time, recognizing that you are worth it, that you deserve love. And I know this, maybe that sounds a little corny, but, like, that's just, I think that's all working in this movie on top of everything else, on top of it being just a really fun summer blockbuster.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think part of that is why I actually prefer this to the original Ant-Man. I think it also just, like, it treats its supporting characters a bit better than that film does. Like, I think the Judy Greer character in the first one is just kind of, like, unfortunately a bit of, like, a nagging ex-wife role. Mm-hmm. And I think it's she doesn't have really more screen time in this one than she does in that one. But there's just more texture to it and just more of, like, oh, she seems like someone that I could understand why Scott would even be with in the past, you know. And, like, mm-hmm. Bobby Cannavale is just fun in this movie, and he's just, like, supportive, like, stepdad, instead of just, like, I'm a cop and I don't like you because you're a criminal, like, in the first movie, which is, like, kind of dumb. I think the characterization of Hope in Ant-Man is strong, but the film doesn't know how to use her well. And I think in this one, she's used much better. She's elevated to co-star of the film. Her character is in the title. And I think that it really honors that promotion in a way. Like, she really is an active force in the film in a way that character always needed to be. And as someone who had not seen Lost when I first watched these movies, but have now seen Lost, have to say, I really enjoy the way that Evangeline Lilly is used in these films and, like, the performance that she gives. I think Lost was a great showcase for all the things that she could do well, but also a show that consistently didn't know what to do with her character. And they really put her in a lot of positions I don't think she ever should have been in. So I'm happy to see her here. I'm glad she didn't retire from acting as she intended after Lost ended, even though she should probably stay off of Twitter. and the last thing I want to say, like, it's kind of like, you know, de rigueur at this point, but the de-aging scene at the beginning of this movie is just unbelievable. And I think that we kind of take it for granted now because Marvel has done this so many times. But, like, just look over to their corporate cousin, Star Wars, and look at the Mark Hamill de-aging scene in the most recent season of The Mandalorian.
I say apples and oranges though, because, like, it's movies versus TV. I know, I made the argument.
That line has gotten so blurry, though.
Yeah.
Like, it really has.
And especially the budget on a season of Mandalorian is, I don't think, that much different from the budget of Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is one of the lower budgeted movies that that Marvel puts out, because it doesn't perform as well as, like, an Iron Man, so they don't really invest in it in exactly the same way. So I feel like it's more comparable than you're giving it credit for, and just, like, the result is just so drastically different. Like, it's incredible how much it just looks like Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer filmed this scene in, like, 1992, and then they just put it on ice for 20 years.
Put it on ice.
Like that short movie being put, that short movie with John Malkovich that's in that barrel of wine that takes 100 years to age.
Did you make that up?
Oh my gosh.
That sounds incredible.
No, that's an actual thing.
Oh my god, there's a certain thing that happened. Yeah.
John, but like a bunch of big names are in it, and the movie will not be released until that vintage wine is ready in like 21.
Oh, yeah. Was it directed by Robert Rodriguez?
I think it was.
I think so.
Like
yeah.
A lot of big names were involved in it. It was a big deal. Yeah. And we will all be dead by the time it comes out.
Yep.
Great. Well, looking forward to it then.
Read more crack.com, Alex. That's the lesson of the day.
So I just wanted to give us, I think we've run through the four movies and kind of given some of our thoughts. I guess I just wanted to hear from you guys, like, revisiting these movies. Do you have any, like, more general thoughts about the MCU?
I guess my general thought is I love that after phase one, they started taking more chances with different genres. Like I said, Ant-Man was like the caper movie, and you could say that Iron Man is like this, you know, PTSD war kind of movie. I mean, they took more chances with indie directors. They took more chances with just fitting the MCU style, this very distinct look and feel, but within these genres that you wouldn't necessarily think were possible with, you know, I mean, Guardians is a great example of which, like, how can you possibly, like, pitch that movie to an executive and say, here's a bunch of characters that not even comic book nerds care about. Like, they don't even give a shit about the Guardians of the Galaxy. But we're going to make a movie about it, and it's going to be unlike any MCU movie that's come before it. Like, how do you pitch that? And I just think those risks and chances that they've taken have all been home runs, which is crazy to think about. Like, they can literally make a movie or Disney Plus series about any character, and as long as they have the right talent involved, it's going to be great for them. It's going to be just super successful. WandaVision, another example. Let's take the two characters that you cared about the least from the Avengers movies, and we're going to make an entirely super weird series about them, like Twin Peaksian level weird, and you're going to love it, and you're going to fight about it online for like 8 weeks. Like, it just makes no sense at like how they're doing things. It's on a different level. It makes you really angry at DC, and they're like, guys, the formula's right there. Do what they're doing. You have the library of characters. Do what they're doing. Do more of that. Less of everything else you're doing.
And it's interesting because I think I've commented on this show actually before. The irony is for the completely non-initiated people who have zero interest in comic book lore, DC actually has the more beloved and well-known characters. Comparatively. Yeah. So if we were to go back 20 years and say, which one of these two are actually going to manage to make a successful extended universe, pretty much anyone would have said, oh, DC, of course.
On paper, for characters. Sure.
Yeah, on paper,
for sure.
Everyone, that would have been everyone's prediction.
Yeah.
Especially when you figure, like, they didn't have Spider-Man or the X-Men at the time, which really...
They didn't have any of the A-listers.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about that on, I think Alex was on the episode of Socially Distanced where, we had to explain to Bill that I'm like, Bill, pre-2008, Iron Man was a D-list character.
Yeah,
he was very resistant to accept that. Who knew he was such a big fan of Iron Man?
I know. It was so funny to explain it to him. And that's just, again, it all goes back down to the storytelling and the people who were involved. Jon Favreau is an indie director. They, you know, pre-Iron Man, he's an indie director. He made what, Zatura or whatever? Like, that's like his biggest budget movie before that, right? Like, it's the guy who made...
He made Elf,
right? Yeah. Like, that was... So it's just, it's nuts, like, the people they got involved. Peyton Reed, the guy that did Down with Love. I love that movie.
And Bring It On.
But, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, the people that... I mean, the guy, John Watt, the director of Homecoming and Far From Home and now No Way Home... He had like one or two movies under his belt, one of which was like a movie with like Kevin Bacon in a cop car. And I think it's literally called Cop Car. Like,
it's good.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, they're picking talent. They're not picking like, you know, names.
Yeah.
It's true. And I think that like rewatching these four movies in particular, what really brought home to me was, you know, the obviously I didn't like The Dark World, right? And I said watching it again made me like it even less. But the other movies, like, they have a very rewatchable quality to them. And I think even the things about Dark World that I don't like is because they're not utilizing these characters that I'm actually interested in ways that are very effective. And like, I always think back, like, there's this podcast that I listen to from The Ringer called The Watch, hosted by Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald. And what they always talk about with TV is that great TV is designed to make you want to hang out with these characters once a week. Like, that is, if a television show gets you to the point where you're just invested in these characters and you just want to spend time with them, then they can do anything. Because that is what a good television show does. And I really think that Kevin Feige understands that in this interconnected universe that he's creating, that he's learned that lesson and applied it to these films. Because at the end of the day, you just want to spend time with these characters. You are invested in what's going to happen to them, and you also just feel like they're like friends that you want to hang out with. Like, you want to sit down for 2 hours and like hang out with your buddies, you know, Tony and Rhodey, and like talk and like have a beer and just like talk, like shoot the shit. And like, if you're willing to do that, then like whatever else happens is fine, you know? And I think that's what these movies do so well. What makes them so good in terms of rewatchability, because it's just an excuse to spend more time with them again. And now, is that the height of art? Like, not always, for sure. There's room to be challenged, right? And I like it when these types of projects challenge you emotionally, intellectually, and I think that you are starting to see more and more of that in some of the stuff that they're doing on the television side of things. But I think that ultimately, you know, you start from a base of just wanting to spend time with these people, and then you're willing to go where the creative vision wants you to go. And I think that's just a thing that people just don't really take the time in a lot of Hollywood movies to do. Like, you think about like the Kong and Godzilla movies, like, none of those characters matter. Who cares? Like, they carried over some of the Godzilla people into the new Kong versus Godzilla. Like, nobody cares. Like, those, I don't even know what those people's names are. It doesn't matter, right? Like, and that's the thing. Like, these people, like, a lot of the times, like, they just, you don't care about them. You don't want to spend time with them. And so then it's hard to be consistently asked to go new places and explore new worlds and do new things. And so I think that that's the biggest lesson from the MCU that people just really don't appreciate as much as they really should.
Yeah, that's a takeaway that stands out to me, you know, looking back across all the films, with a handful of exceptions, you know, of my personal favorites and the ones that I think are the best, you know, like Black Panther or Thor Ragnarok. I think of the MCU less in terms of individual films and more in terms of the characters. And I think less in terms of, oh, what are my favorite movies, but rather, what are my favorite scenes or my favorite moments from these particular characters when I had the most fun with them?
Yeah, and I'll just say, like, rewatching some of these, watching some of them for the first time. So, first of all, very weird seeing Paramount logos for First Avenger. I was like, wait, but I'm on Disney Plus, like, what is happening? Like, and then I was like, oh right, like, there's a whole thing, like, Disney did not always own the MCU. That aside, I did think I do agree with you, Alex. Like, I was surprised how rewatchable a lot of these were. I mean, some of them I had seen and like really enjoyed the first time. I'm like, well, is there really going to be like a lot to, you know, like, what am I going to get on a rewatch? And apparently I feel like I enjoyed these movies even more than the first time I saw them, so I guess I got something out of it. And yeah, I do think you're right. I think it is. It's very much about character. I think that's really what's been the success of this. And you know, the characters that are on screen specifically, right? Like, I think Al, you mentioned that they could probably make a movie out of any character from the MCU. I would even contend they could just flat out make one up and then just slap the Marvel logo on it, and it would still work.
If they announce tomorrow that there's going to be a half hour sitcom comedy on Disney Plus starring Korg, I'm in. Like, I'm in. Yeah, like, you can literally make it about any of these characters because they're so well written and developed and just executed on. The talent, the acting talent that we don't stress enough, is just like, they know how to cast these so goddamn well. It's crazy.
Yeah, and they also know how to spend the time to establish these characters. Like, if you look at a film like Captain America, The First Avenger, to go back one of those that we've been talking about, they spend, like, 45 minutes. Really, like, you get a couple of scenes moving the plot along, but the vast majority of it is just spending time with Steve, spending time with the people in Steve's life, allowing him to go on this journey and to be developed not just as a hero, but as a character. So by the time that you get to the point where he loses Bucky in that train sequence, that means something to you as an audience member, because you are invested in who Steve is, who Bucky was, and that relationship that they have. And that's just really hard to do in films in general. And I think it's in Hollywood blockbuster movies, there's usually so much shorthand that gets involved, because it's like, well, we got to get to the action scene, we got to get to the next action beat, we got to get the plot moving, we got to get all of these side characters serviced, we got to do this. And it's just, they do not spend the time. And I think the Marvel movies do, and it pays off dividends, because then you can get a movie like Infinity War, where there's like literally dozens of characters, and you have like one scene for like every set piece, and it's just, and it moves so fast. It's doing all those things that Hollywood action movies do, but you've had all of this time that's spent actually establishing these characters in other films that you can just pay it off now. And I think that it's just something that we really haven't seen before at this scale. And I think that a lot of other studios have tried to do it and they failed, because they don't spend the attention to character that Marvel does.
All right. I guess we'll close it up there, but let's talk about where we can find everybody these days. And I think I'll start with our guest, Al. Where is the best place to find you on the internet?
Well, I just want to say thank you again for having me on. This is so much fun. Love talking about Marvel at any opportunity, as Alex knows.
It's our pleasure.
And just comic book stuff in general. You can find me at Al Manarino on Instagram and Twitter. And you can also just go to thepopbreak.com to see all the amazing content that our writers, including Alex, and all the amazing podcasts we have on there. As Alex is a host of a few, and I am a host of the Socially Distanced podcast, which you can find on Apple, Anchor, Spotify, Stitcher, I believe, and a few other places. So, yeah, if you want to hear more of my ranting and absolute obsession with both comic books and the band Phoenix, you can check out that podcast.
Nice. Let's go to you next, Noah. Where's the best place to find you online?
All right. Well, in addition to my work with the boys here in Cinema Joes, you can also check out the work that Justin and I did along with my brother Luke for Pod on the Rooftops, a podcast about the discography of the band Genesis. And you can also check out my written work at my blog, francenoir.blogspot.com.
Yes, and I will echo the recommendation for our now finished, now completed podcast, which you can find, probably the best place to find that would be on thepopbreak.com. And for my individual work, you can find me at thecinemaverick.com. That's my website. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. And let's go to you, Alex.
Okay, so you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow, as Justin said, my other podcast, TV Break, which I host with Bill Bodkin and Josh Chernacki, once a month, on Wednesday, the first Wednesday of every month, for Pop Break TV. You could continue to subscribe to Pop Break TV for another show of mine, Goodbye to All That, which is like an after party for our favorite shows. Last month we covered WandaVision with Caleb Borchard. This month we're going to be covering Falcon and the Winter Soldier with Michael T. Ford III. Very excited for that. Now that show is wrapped up. That podcast also features other podcasts about television, reality shows, dramas. We have weekly roundups. We cover The Bachelor. We cover Married at First Sight. We also cover anniversaries and all other stuff. So definitely check that out. One of my favorite things on that feed is Blurred Watchers, which is also covering a lot of Marvel content, along with Amazon's Invincible and other stuff like that. That comes out the second to last Wednesday of every month, so definitely check that out over there. As you said, I'm also the podcast editor for PopBreak.com. In addition to PopBreak TV, we have a separate feed called The Breakcast, which has a new episode out every Tuesday covering movies and music and anime and manga and wrestling as well. So definitely check that out. One of the new shows that we have is called Talking Makota, hosted by Noah's brother Luke, where he talks about artists who are gone too soon, whose careers ended early, and he interviews a guest and talks about it, and their first episode is up right now on that feed, talking all about the artist Selena. So definitely check that out as well. As for our show, you can follow at Cinema Joes on Twitter, and you can go over to my Letterboxd, where I have a playlist up of all of the movies that we have reviewed since we started, so you can check that out too, and that's under at Media Thinkings.
Well, thank you for that, Alex, and we're going to close it up there. We want to thank all of our listeners and all of our subscribers. Thank you for sticking with us. For now, for the Cinema Joes, this is Justin Mancini signing off.